It is really my privilege to introduce Ken Salazar. He's a fifth-generation Coloradan who was a farmer, a lawyer, and a small businessman before he was a politician. So he had some real jobs. He's had some real jobs after that, too. He was the executive director of the Colorado Department of Natural Resources. He was the Colorado Attorney General. He was a U.S. Senator. And now he is President Obama's Interior Secretary. And throughout his career, Secretary Salazar has been deeply involved in environmental issues, water issues, extraction industry issues, land conservation issues, and renewable energy issues. For those of us who covered the Gail Norton era at Interior, I don't think there's a lot of doubt that Secretary Salazar has really ushered in change. He'll be trying to persuade everyone that it's change we can believe in. A few bullet points about his time in the cabinet. After the BP spill, the secretary launched the most significant overhaul of offshore oil and gas regulation in U.S. history. The secretary has also been a huge advocate of renewable energy development in the Southwest and offshore. He recently visited the first two commercial-scale solar projects under construction on U.S. public lands. He's also approved another 11 in the last 18 months, which is a very big deal. And the secretary is a big part of the administration's America's Great Outdoors initiative. He's going to be showing us a restoration project in the Everglades tomorrow on the swamp slog, so a lot of us are really looking forward to that. I should also mention Secretary Salazar's side job. He's an abuelo. He and his wife, Hope, have two daughters and a granddaughter named Mareva. So now I'm going to sit down and let Secretary Salazar explain how he's trying to conserve America's natural resources for Mareva. And afterwards, he'll take some questions.
Thank you very much, Michael. And bienvenidos a todos aquí a la Florida. So all of you from Latin America, thank you for being here. All those of you from Europe, and I think it does show that the Society for Environmental Journalism and all that you do here recognize a reality which people like my friend Jane Lubchenco and I understand, that we truly are one planet. There is no them and us. And so your celebration here today is something that I'm very honored to be a part of. So thank you for inviting me. It's a great honor for me to be here and to be with people who I have worked with and known for a long time. Donna Shalala, a wonderful friend for many years and who did an outstanding job as Secretary for Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration. And as a president of the University of Miami, we have a lot that we work with her on. Jane Lubchenco, who was honored with an honorary doctorate at Colorado College many years ago. Very good friend of mine, and we work on many natural resources and environmental issues. Dan Ash, the director of the best fish and wildlife agency on Earth, Dan Ash, overseeing our 10,000 people. And I know you will be hearing from John Jarvis, will actually be with us as we travel around the Everglades, and you go to Big Cypress tomorrow, and he is doing a Herculean job with our National Park Service. And I also want to acknowledge Marcia McNutt, the head of our U.S. Geological Survey, and another Colorado College graduate, will actually be here on, I think, Saturday or Sunday, addressing all of you. And I want to also just say thank you to Dan Kimball and Pedro Ramos, the superintendents of Everglades National Park and Big Cypress, and to Mario Diaz-Balart, a congressman who joined me at the Latino Heritage Forum with President Obama just this last Wednesday. Thank you for being here. Now, just 15 months ago, the eyes of the world were on the Gulf states and on the Gulf of Mexico, so it's appropriate that this conference is being held here in Florida today. Morning, noon, and night, for 87 days, Americans were gripped by the news and the near-constant images of oil that was spewing from a well 1 mile below the ocean surface and washing up on the shores of the United States. Readers and viewers were hungry for as much information about the spill as they could get, about the battle to protect the coastlines, about our unprecedented fight to kill the well, and about what the crisis meant for the wildlife and water and the people of the Gulf Coast. No doubt, Deepwater Horizon was one of the biggest environmental stories of our lifetimes. For 9 weeks, it was a top news story in the United States of America. It consumed 22% of all the mainstream news coverage for over 100 days. On TV, it was even higher. CNN devoted 42% of its entire airtime to the spill and to the massive government response that we mobilized. And as we kick off this conference, with the benefit of a year in hindsight, September 19th was when we declared the well dead. It's worth taking a quick look back because it has some lessons to the conservation issues that we face today. It's worth asking, what can we learn, not just from the tragedy itself, but also from Americans' intense interest and media coverage of the spill itself? What can we learn? There are, in my view, two historic lessons in particular that I would call your attention to. The first is that the Deepwater Horizon coverage during that 100-day-plus stretch demonstrated that Americans feel strongly about conservation and about the outdoors. We are all moved by the sight of oil washing on our beaches or of a pelican being captured and scrubbed. It is angering. We feel that it shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen anywhere, and it shouldn't happen here. Those are our beaches. Those are our neighbors. The fish and wildlife are our legacy of conservation and of this earth. But it's not just about an oil spill that Americans care about. Even in tough economic times, Americans are going to the polls to support more parks and more open space. You all here are journalists, so you followed the 2010 election with great interest and what it meant in terms of the changes that are happening and have happened in Washington. Yet in that election in 2010, voters approved a new trust fund for water and wildlife and trails in the state of Iowa. And Maine voters approved a new bond for waterfront protection and for parks. And at voting booths across more than half of the states of the United States, Americans made their feelings known about conservation, about clean energy, about energy efficiency, and about the environment. So Americans care about conservation, they care about our outdoors, and they care about the natural legacy of our planet. Lesson two, looking back from this intense coverage of the Deepwater Horizon, is that Americans are demanding more sophisticated reporting about the environment. And that's where you all come in as a society of environmental journalists. People in this country are demanding that knowledge and information about the natural world is available to them and how the natural world is changing. Yes, our attention spans are shorter in the digital age, and yes, there is a demand for sound bites, bulletins, and punditry. Those of us in the political arena know that very well. But Deepwater Horizon also proved that there is also a huge appetite and appreciation for complicated information, for scientific perspectives, and for nuanced reporting. How else do you explain that terms like loop current, blowout preventer, and hydrates became familiar terms in American households? The oil spill put a premium on good reporting. It put a premium on good reporters. Americans relied on you in this room and people throughout the world who are watching you for clear and understandable explanations of what was happening and how it would affect our world. Reporters who cover energy and the environment rose to the challenge. Ann Thompson of NBC was out on the boats day after day, covering the fight to protect the coastlines and talking about what we must do to restore the Gulf from long-term decline. Jennifer DeLoy of the Houston Chronicle dug more than anyone ever had into offshore oil and gas regulation and helped her readers understand the paradigms that had been established and the new paradigms that were being established to provide safety and oversight in the Outer Continental Shelf. So many of you kept long hours, often staying in hotels miles away from your family and your friends, and put the spotlight where it needed to be. So we must not forget the lessons of the Deepwater Horizon. We must press forward with our oil and gas reforms. We must press forward with protecting America's oceans, wildlife, and fisheries. And we must keep our commitment to Gulf Coast restoration and reinvest what will be a significant penalty in the restoration of the Gulf of Mexico in a more holistic fashion than has ever happened before. But I also ask you as journalists that you take stock of the lessons that we learn, perhaps a deeper set of lessons, that the American people want to know, that they need to know, that other big conservation stories are happening in this country that very much affect their lives. I'd like to speak very briefly about three of those stories that I think need attention, and they need attention now, and you are the instruments of providing that attention to the American people. First, there's an untold story about conservation that is happening across America. There are big things and great things happening in the land and water conservation across the country that we should all know about and all Americans should know about. I'm talking about the countless locally driven, consensus-based conservation efforts that have taken root across this country. They don't get much attention because there often is no conflict involved. But what's happening in the rivers of America, what's happening in the Dakota grasslands and the Flint Hills of Kansas, and what's happening right here in the Everglades, as you will see tomorrow, is nothing short of a revolution on behalf of conservation. And it is the root of the 21st conservation agenda, which we have worked on in the Obama administration. President Teddy Roosevelt changed America with his own conservation revolution a long time ago. He did it in a different time, when we were a smaller country with wide open spaces left to be developed, creating the national forests, the refuges, and parks with the stroke of his pen. Today, ordinary Americans are having an impact just as large through the cumulative efforts at the local level. President Barack Obama's America's Great Outdoors initiative, which we launched last year, is empowering and encouraging and supporting these local efforts because we know what is making a difference, and it's making a difference on the ground. Tomorrow I will have the honor with Director Ash to visit the boardwalk at Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge. That is America's first national wildlife refuge. Each plank that we will place on the Pelican National Wildlife Refuge Centennial Boardwalk is a part of the legacy of ordinary Americans over the last several years. I would not be laying the planks there tomorrow if the ranchers in South Dakota had not stood up and said, "We want to protect our ranch lands and the wetlands and America's duck factory right here in South Dakota." Or if the Livestock Association, in a very conservative part of Kansas, had not joined conservation groups to say, "Let's protect America's last 1.1 million acres of the short grass prairie in the Flint Hills of Kansas." Nor would it have happened in the other places that we will honor tomorrow, including the Cherry Valley Wildlife Refuge in Pennsylvania, or Tulare Basin in California. So each of these stories on the creation of the new national conservation areas, which we have announced, and other stories that are going on around the country, from the restoration of the Klamath River and the San Joaquin River in California, to the creation of the 3-million-acre binational conservation area between the United States and Mexico at Big Bend. Those are all stories that should be told, and there are hundreds and thousands of those stories all across the country. Tomorrow, we at Interior will begin to tell 100 more great stories about conservation and recreation across the country. Based on meetings that we've had with the governors and teams of governors in each one of those 50 states, we will roll out 2 conservation projects in each state. So 100 conservation projects across the 50 states of America. And they will be in the manifestation of the America's Great Outdoors priorities. These projects are locally driven conservation initiatives that we hope to move along under the mantle of America's Great Outdoors. Now, many of these projects are not headline grabbers, but each one of them is very meaningful to its local community. They will bring about new trails for bikers, new blue ways for boaters, open spaces for families, and many other forms of recreation and possibilities for connecting up our young people and the people of this country to the great outdoors. This is a good time to be reminded of some of the things we can get done when we work together from the ground up, regardless of party. Earlier today, and the United States Senate. I joined Democratic and Republican former colleagues of mine in the U.S. Senate to talk about the Flint Hills and how it had come together, to talk about the Dakota grasslands and how we were moving forward with that conservation area, to talk about Tulare Basin, the largest wetland west of the Mississippi, and to talk about what we were doing in Pennsylvania to restore one of the most precious habitats in that place. So it's important that we tell those stories of what is going on, because conservation should be an American idea that isn't known as a place that only belongs to Democrats or to Republicans. It's a story that belongs to everyone. The second story, so the first story is one of the successes that we are seeing all across this country, even in these very difficult times. But the second story that needs attention and which you can help bring attention to is how conservation relates to the economy. Last summer, oil spill laid bare the inextricable connection between the health of land and water and the health of our economy. With oil in the Gulf, fishermen were out of work. Hotels were empty. Restaurants were closed. And the economy of the Gulf Coast seemed to hang very much on the brink. Beyond the crisis, though, we do not focus nearly enough attention on the economic implications of good stewardship of America's land and its water, its wildlife, and its oceans. The fact is, America's great outdoors are a massive economic engine for this nation. More than 15 million Americans hunt, more than 28 million Americans fish. Outdoor recreation and conservation is estimated to bring in about $1 trillion a year through its industries every single year. And leisure and hospitality and outdoor recreation together are the fifth largest employment sector in the United States economy. Recreation in our national parks, our refuges, and other public lands alone led to about $55 billion in economic contribution and almost 500 million jobs in this country. So to the extent to which our land, water, and wildlife heal our economy, we believe that it is a story that is not adequately understood or reported. And unfortunately, that knowledge gap can have real consequences when people make decisions about investments and fiscal priorities. And those decisions are decisions that are being made now and between now and December 23rd of this year in Washington, D.C. Third point, it's important for us to describe what is at stake for conservation. Here in the Everglades, we have undertaken the largest watershed restoration project on the planet. And over the last 2 years, the Obama administration, including the Department of the Interior and our colleagues at EPA, the Army Corps of Engineers, USDA, a federal family working as one, have moved mountains to provide additional funding and to move Everglades restoration from planning to on-the-ground results. Unlike times past, we do not believe in just the talk. We have been walking the talk over the last 2.5 years. And as a result, what you will see tomorrow is that some of that work underway at the Tamiami Trail and so many other places around the Everglades are restoring the Everglades and the river of grass in a way that we in this country can be proud of. And when that restoration moves forward, what we will see is the largest ecosystem restoration project in the entire world, which is unfolding before our very eyes. We will soon see the river of grass flowing again. Tomorrow we'll also talk about a new conservation initiative, the Everglades National Wildlife Refuge. That refuge proposal will preserve the community's ranching heritage and conserve the headwaters and fish and wildlife of the Everglades. And we'll discuss the work we have underway to plan for the next 10 years, for the next 10 years of Everglades restoration. I ask you to see for yourself as you see the work underway tomorrow. But the remarkable progress you've made on conservation in the last 2.5 years here in the Everglades and around the country is very much in jeopardy. It is not simply a matter of budgets, although the House Republican budget would force the closure of an estimated 100 national wildlife refuges to the public. It's about a fundamentally different vision of who we are as a nation and what we can do as a people. The President and I believe that when times are tough, Americans need to stand together, work together, and do big things together. But we are faced with a competing vision of America that when times are tough, it's every person for themselves, where we shy away from our goals, where we say that it's too difficult, that mountain is too high to climb. And that's why you see attacks underway today on efforts such as the San Joaquin River restoration effort, which we saw water flowing in the San Joaquin for the first time in 50 years last year. And other attacks that we're seeing on the Grand Canyon and other great places of our nation. It's also why we see folks turning their backs on the promise of the Land and Water Conservation Fund. We should be reinvesting the revenues from oil and gas resources and the royalties that are produced from the OCS into permanent protection of rivers and parks and wildlife habitat. It's common sense. It was a promise that was made more than 40 years ago. And yet those revenues are not getting to where they should be. Over time, $32 billion were supposed to go from those royalty revenues into the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And today, when you look at the books of the United States Treasury, you'll see that there's $16 billion that is owed to the Land and Water Conservation Fund. The money has simply not made it to the authorized and intended end. So when you think about $16 billion owed to the Land and Water Conservation Fund, if you're a hunter in this country, you've been shorted. If you are a fisherman in this country, you have been shorted. And if you are an energy company, you've been shorted, because that was part of the grand bargain. We developed the OCS, but we'd invest in conservation. And so the American people expect much more from their leaders, but they have to know what's happening. And that's why you as journalists carry a tremendous responsibility. 15 months ago, you helped the world understand what happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And you did. And you helped mobilize an army of citizens and public servants to respond. The challenges we face today in conservation deserve the same relentless attention, careful reporting, and clear explanation. The American people are interested in the great outdoors. They are passionate. And they need your expertise to bring them the information that they seek. I will conclude with two stories. The first is a story from Brazil. I was there about 6 months ago in a meeting on a Saturday morning with the NGOs who are involved in conservation, including the Nature Conservancy and others. And their work that's going on in conservation across the 13 countries of Latin America is truly inspiring work, and it's inspiring to see the journalists here from Latin America. But there was a young man there, not so young anymore, probably in his 50s, who told me the story about the monkey. He said that he'd gone down to Brazil to work on something called the golden tamarin monkey some 30 years ago. And people thought that he was kind of dumb when he came into town because nobody liked the monkey. Monkey was this creature that smelled and spit on people, and if you got near, it would scratch you. So it was better to get rid of the monkey. So people laughed at him, didn't think that he would be able to get very far. But he started working on conservation initiatives and providing education and providing additional information to the people of Rio and the people of Brazil and to the ranchers whose water supply and water quality were so dependent on the rivers. So fast forward to this event that I had in Brazil to talk about conservation and rivers and the connectedness of rivers. And he said, from that time when people thought that I was out of my mind to come down here and work on saving this monkey, today people are happy. The people who thought I should be taken and stoned and run out of town are happy. The farmers and ranchers and the municipalities are happy because their water supply has been protected. And yes, the golden tamarin monkey is thriving in this place in Brazil. And he said to me, what brought people together here on this project, on this conservation initiative, was the fact that people found out that there was a connectivity all related to the rivers, that the monkey needed the canopy for extended miles in order to be able to have the habitat that the monkey needed. And the cities and the farmers and ranchers needed to have the water quality and the water supply protected. And so today, the farmers and the cities and the conservationists and the monkey are all happy in Brazil. So part of our challenge in conservation, when I look at the work that Dan Ash and John Jarvis and all of our team does in the Obama administration, is how we connect up these lands for conservation. So that's why when we speak about the Dakota grasslands, we're talking about both South Dakota and North Dakota, and about several million acres. It's important that we have that kind of connectivity. When we talk about what's happening with rivers, as Dan Ash and Mike Connor and I spoke yesterday on the Middle Rio Grande, we can't just look at tribal lands and those lands that are run by the Bureau of Reclamation and BLM lands and those that are in private lands. We need to look at the river as a whole, because there's a connectivity there for the silvery minnow, for recreation, and for the many other uses of the river. So we need to look at connectivity as a central feature that brings us together with respect to landscape conservation cooperatives and the other conservation initiatives that we are working on all around the country. And the last and final comment and story I will leave you with is this. I was still a young man running for the Attorney General's office in the state of Colorado. Most people in 1997 and 98 thought that I couldn't win, because Colorado, for a lot of reasons in those days, was very much a Republican state. Both U.S. senators and the governor and everybody on the cabinet was a Republican, with the exception I won that year, so I became Attorney General. But we went through this long discussion about what my motto should be as I ventured off into running for Colorado Attorney General. And I'd been involved in my state and doing a program called the Great Outdoors Colorado Program, which created a trust fund for conservation. And I thought about my own ranching background and how I had spent so much of my time on rivers and the great Rocky Mountains of Colorado. And I decided that the motto should be fighting for Colorado's land, water, and people. Fighting for Colorado's land, water, and people. That was my motto as I went on to become the only Democrat to be elected in any statewide office in Colorado in 1998. And I did the same thing when I ran for the U.S. Senate in 2004 and again won that successful race. Now, I still remember the debate about whether my motto was wrong, because there were some people who said, how can you be talking about land and water when you should be talking about the people? And I said, well, you cannot take care of the people, and you cannot take care of this state unless you take care of the land and water of this state. So when I think about the conservation challenges that we face today in 2011, it's still much about the same fight. It's carrying forward with the conservation agenda that said that people in tough times stand up to the challenges. People ask me, why can you be out there talking about conservation and full funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund today when there's so many other issues that our country faces? And I like to remind them that it was Abraham Lincoln, in the midst of the bloodiest war that the United States has ever fought, right here on our own soil with 600,000 people plus killed in that war, who had the courage to set aside the lands that became Yosemite National Park. And I like to remind them that it was Teddy Roosevelt, as the Industrial Revolution was laying waste to much of our country's space, became the greatest conservation president and perhaps the greatest conservation leader that the earth knows. And I like to remind them that it was in 1935, in the midst of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, that Franklin Roosevelt and his people passed the Migratory Bird Conservation Act, which now has funded much of the conservation initiatives that we know in these times. And it was in the 1960s when Stuart Udall and John Kennedy decided that the Land and Water Conservation Fund made sense, notwithstanding all the other tough issues that they were facing in those days. So yes, in 2011, we here in the United States are facing some very tough times. No doubt the deficit and the fiscal issues of the country are difficult. And no doubt the jobs issue, which we all face, are difficult issues. But when you take the long view of what is good for the United States of America, it is time that the voices of conservation are voices that are heard loud and clear. And so for all the organizations that are out there making sure that in the halls of Congress, in both the U.S. House of Representatives and in the United States Senate, and in all arms of the federal government, that the voice of conservation is heard loud and clear, it's really important. And so you as journalists have an incredible opportunity to make sure that that story of conservation is told in these very hard times of decision. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, the secretary has agreed to take a few questions. The rules apparently are journalists only. Identify yourself first, and don't make a speech, because this really has to go fast. So, anybody out there? Yes, go ahead.
I'm Mark Schlefstein. I'm a reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. Mr. Secretary, I'm from the state of Senator David Vitter, Representatives Jeff Landry and Steve Scalise, who say there's still a moratorium in place that's costing the oil industry jobs in our state, while at the same time, residents along our coast and the coast of other Gulf states are complaining that more oil was washed ashore this summer by Tropical Storm Lee. And I'm trying to find out what exactly is your office as Secretary of the Department of Interior doing to assure that both of those issues are properly addressed?
First, with respect to our oil and gas activities in the Gulf, they are basically back to the place where they were before the Macondo spill. And we have, as we have moved forward with that effort, we also have accomplished the greatest overhaul in the history of oil and gas development in America's oceans. There's still a lot of work to do. Part of what we need to do is to make sure we get the right resources from Congress so that we can do the inspections and do everything else that that we need to do. On the second issue that you raise, there is, in fact, still oil in the Gulf of Mexico today, and we're going to continue to see tar balls and other things that will come up on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico for some time to come. Earlier today, I had an interesting conversation with Dr. McNutt about where the oil is, and I'm sure that Dr. Lubchenco also has thoughts that she can share with you on that. But the Gulf oil spill still lives with us today. As I was thinking about the Pew Research, which I cited as showing that the oil spill had really been the most intensely covered press event of its day, I was also thinking about how much amnesia people have, that many people have now forgotten a lot about the oil spill, but the reality of it is we still are very much in an active cleanup mode and have lots of people who are still working on the cleanup.
We're going to go to semi-lightning round. So.
Okay. I'll be short in my answers. You'll be short in your questions. I'll be short in my answers. So my apologies.
Sure
go
that,
here,
sure
here, here, here.
Short, but, hi, Jeff Young. I'm with a public
Jeff.
Radio program called Living on Earth. Good to see you again. My question has to do with the recent decisions to permit drilling in the Chukchi Sea, and there's a lot of concern that perhaps the lessons from the Gulf oil spill have not been learned. What assurances do you have that you have reviewed in a sound scientific manner those permit decisions, and that we have a viable plan if, God forbid, there is a spill in that very difficult environment? Thank you.
First of all, no decision has been made on either the Beaufort or the Chukchi. We're moving forward with it, and it may happen. But all of the issues from oil spill to oil spill response to the science issues are being evaluated. And secondly, I would say that if explorations do, in fact, go forward, one of the things that you will see is a development of additional information, which is very helpful for us as we make science-based decisions about the future. So the fact that if you look at both the Beaufort and the Chukchi Sea, there have been dozens of exploratory wells that have been drilled in that area over the last three decades. So the moving forward with exploration wells does not foretell what ultimately will happen with development or what that pace will be or where it will happen. Go here.
Secretary Salazar, I'm Tali Nauman, and I'm the Health and Environment Editor for the Native Sun News in the grasslands of South Dakota.
Good. Give her a round of applause. She comes from a great place.
There's not many of us out there. But anyway, my most recent story that comes out today is about the land acquired by Wind Cave National Park in the news release. There were four of news releases about that. You mentioned the importance of a very little-known story in which that national park donated bison for repatriation of the bison in Mexico that had completely vanished. If you could please give us just a comment on the importance of that. And my other question is, we cover the Keystone XL pipeline controversy, and I want to know if you think that the president's, well, that the State Department's decision, that the administration's decision will be based on principle or on political pragmatism.
You know, the Keystone pipeline, obviously that is in Secretary Clinton's camp, and she is going through that process. We are involved through the Fish and Wildlife Service, as are other agencies, and I am not going to foretell and don't know where that decision ultimately will end up. On the Dakota grasslands and the donations that have been made in that area, part of the new era of conservation, as I see it, is an era where it is not the federal government coming in and buying up millions and millions of acres, but it's actually working with people who will donate property. That's why the Nature Conservancy, the TPL, and so many other organizations are so important in helping us broker those deals. And also moving forward with conservation easements, which is basically is at the root of both the Dakota grasslands, the Flint Hills, and the Everglades headwaters, and a number of other areas. Yes.
My name's Carlton Ward, Jr., and I'm a photojournalist who's spent a lot of time photographing ranch lands here in Florida. And I really appreciate what you're doing to protect the Everglades headwaters. And was hoping, as a rancher yourself, whether you could offer some perspective about the role the ranching and agriculture are playing in this effort to protect the Everglades.
I think in the Everglades, as in 100 or more conservation areas, the crown of the continent, the ones that I've already spoken about, so many other areas, it's the ranchers who are actually making this happen. When I sat down with the ranchers in the Flint Hills of Kansas, it was the fourth and fifth generation ranchers who said, unless we do something to conserve these Flint Hills tall grass prairies, our ranching heritage of life is going to go away. So I think here in the Everglades, the ranching community is also at the spearhead of the conservation effort. Yes?
Yes, I'm Seth Borenstein with the Associated Press. Almost every year, the president has talked about cutting out energy subsidies to oil companies, especially energy companies in general, but especially oil companies. Can you explain to me how that jibes with increased drilling on permits for drilling on public lands? Aren't those subsidies? Do you not consider those subsidies in some way? How much do we end up paying? I guess for that matter, how do you reconcile increased fossil fuel development on public lands with climate change?
I got your question. So first, we need to make sure that companies are paying their fair share. And we also need to recognize that companies are not paying their fair share in many places. If you look at what oil companies are paying today on the onshore, where we control about 700 million acres through my department of lands here in the United States, which belong to all of you, all the American citizens, pay 12.5% royalty, which is basically the same royalty that was paid in 1920. And you look at what the state of Texas charges, 20%. And so the question is, are taxpayers getting their fair return? And we are addressing that issue both in the oceans as well as on the onshore. With respect to the president's wanting to eliminate subsidies that aren't needed, that's absolutely correct. When you look at the Gulf of Mexico and what's happening with development in the Gulf of Mexico, you can't tell me that the incentives that were created at one time to go into deep water drilling are needed any longer when you have the kind of oil prices that we have today. Yes?
That's the last one.
Carrie Hendry, Island Sandpaper and fifth generation Floridian. I met you in the Everglades one year when I was on an airboat tour with Senator Bill Nelson. I just have one question. Governor Rick Scott recently revealed new restoration plans for the Everglades. Could you comment on that? And if you had any opinion on oil exploration in the Everglades?
Well, oil exploration in the Everglades, we're opposed. Governor Scott and his plan to move forward with a new plan for Everglades restoration. Let me just say two quick things about it. One is the state of Florida, in our last 3 years, has been a very effective partner with us in accomplishing what we have been able to accomplish. We hope that the same thing happens with the new governor. But I will say honestly, the jury is still out. And his plan that he has presented is a plan which we are currently evaluating, because we not only have to restore the habitat in terms of water supply to the River of Grass, but the other thing that we need to do is to address the water quality issues. And so Administrator Jackson, EPA, and others who are working with us want to make sure that we're moving forward on both fronts. But we are encouraged that we have a positive dialogue emerging with Governor Scott, but we'll see where that takes us over the next several weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.